Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back with another EB medicine special, this time on pediatric blunt abdominal trauma. And we see blunt trauma rather frequently, especially in pediatric patients. Often, though, we're thinking of the head with smaller head injuries or to the extremities, but blunt abdominal trauma is one that is often missed initially as far as being something potentially dangerous. Additionally, blunt abdominal trauma is less common but has unique challenges. The patient's developmental stage, limitations in verbal and language skills, the lack of pre-hospital information, and the potential for an unreliable exam creates a situation that can create additional stress to both the family and those taking care of the patient. What we are going to do with this evidence-based medicine special is take an article that was recently published in January, and we are going to review the key aspects so that way we can provide better care to our pediatric patients. If you want to get access to this article, go to our podcast, podcast number 188, and click on the link at the beginning, but also you can find additional details when you scroll down the page. Unfortunately, blunt abdominal trauma is the third most common cause of death in pediatric patients from trauma, with head and thoracic being more common, but it is the most common cause of unrecognized death from trauma. Motor vehicle collisions, or MVCs, are the most common cause of death in children ages 5 to 18 years. The spleen and liver are the most commonly injured abdominal organs, but the kidney, small bowel, and pancreas are also frequently injured. Let's review the pathophysiology. Children present some unique challenges when it comes to their anatomy and their physiology. The abdominal organs are relatively larger in children than adults. They have poorly developed abdominal muscles, less intra-abdominal fat, and a compliant rib cage, which all increases their risk of more significant injuries compared to their adult counterparts. Crying is very common both from pain or fear. And from the crying, they can swallow in a bunch of air, which can lead to gastric distension. And that gastric distension is not one that we can always differentiate being from trauma versus being from the air that they have been swallowing. Crying will often increase the heart rate, but we have to take tachycardia seriously as this is a common early indicator for blood loss. Hypotension, something that we see more in adults, is kind of something that is a good marker for shock or significant injury, is something that shows up much later in children and is a very concerning sign once present. So we have to keep in mind that hypotension should not be something we rely on as an identification of shock in children, at least early on. And when we do see it, we should be extremely concerned that this patient will rapidly deteriorate. Children can become hypothermic more easily than adults, which can worsen shock. And given their small body mass, children are more likely to suffer multiple injuries given the force that is applied to a small body surface area. To help us better identify the different potential injuries and what to look for with different mechanisms, I do want to cover some of the key mechanisms that were discussed from the EB Medicine article. While head injuries are the most common cause of death in MVCs, the pattern injury from MVCs varies by the type of restraint used, the seating position, and the type of accident itself. Appropriate restraints can significantly decrease the risk of intra-abdominal injuries. However, inappropriate restraint, such as lap-only belts or lap-and-shoulder belts in too young of children, can lead to increased injuries with the seatbelt, including hip and abdominal contusions, pelvic fractures, lumbar spine injuries, and intra-abdominal injuries, both of solid organs and hollow viscera. A positive seatbelt sign is very concerning for intra-abdominal trauma with higher rates of gastrointestinal or pancreatic injuries. However, there is some limited evidence that those who had a positive seatbelt sign but no abdominal tenderness did not have an intra-abdominal injury. Side impacts are also potentially concerning as they are more likely to have abdominal injuries compared to frontal impacts. Speaking of vehicles and children, children that are hit as a pedestrian have a very concerning mechanism as their injuries will vary by the speed, angle of impact, center of gravity of the pedestrian, meaning the child, the body part that was contacted by the vehicle first, and the part of the vehicle impacted as well as its design. There can be a broad range of injuries that can occur when children are hit by a vehicle. However, all of these should significantly increase our suspicion for injuries, including blunt abdominal trauma. There has been a trend to an increase in both the incidence and severity of abdominal injuries related to bicycle accidents. Handlebar injuries are often underappreciated in early presentations, but can have a significant underlying injury. And as a result, direct impact with a handlebar requires a high index of suspicion and oftentimes can lead to a delayed presentation of a significant abdominal injury. Kind of speaking along the same lines of bicycles and other types of sports injuries are a less common cause of abdominal injury overall, but the spleen is the most commonly injured. Other organs can be injured, of course, such as the kidneys and liver commonly. American football, rugby, soccer, hockey, cricket, baseball, and even snowboarding are some of the riskier sports for abdominal injuries. Again, most of the time, this involves the spleen. Falls, while the most common cause of non-fatal injuries in children, account for approximately 4% of intra-abdominal injuries, with higher heights, basically 15 feet or higher based on the evidence, is being even more concerning. A worthy note, though, is based on one meta-analysis, no small bowel perforations were caused by falls downstairs, and such injuries with that type of trauma should be very suspicious for non-accidental trauma. In addition, regarding non-accidental trauma, patients tend to be younger, more severely injured, and more often require more serious interventions such as surgery and intensive care. Hollow viscous injuries tend to be more common, as well as a combination of hollow viscous and solid organ injuries. They may also have a delay in seeking care. Now that we better understand the mechanisms, let's talk about the assessment. Just like any patient in trauma, the primary survey should be a key point in the first stage of what we're doing. This is again assessing the ABCDE, or airway, breathing, circulation, disability, environment, and exposure. The focus should be addressing immediate life or limb-threatening injuries, as well as preventing neurological compromise. Point-of-care ultrasound or POCUS should be utilized when available to perform key exams such as the extended focus assessment with sonography and trauma, or the EFAST exam. A focus history is a key aspect of the assessment, but it can be difficult to obtain in children based on their age, clinical condition, availability of and knowledge of the situation by the caregivers, limitations in the patient's verbal skills, and extrinsic motivations such as the patient not wanting to get in trouble and limiting what they tell, or in some cases lying as far as what occurred. Obtaining information such as where and how the injury occurred is vital, as we demonstrated with the mechanisms that we just discussed. Important aspects of the past medical history include any bleeding disorders, anemia, medications, and allergies. The surgical history, such as if there are previous abdominal surgeries, is also important. Whenever possible, we want to know the patient's baseline, and having a reliable caregiver to provide that information is key and beneficial whenever possible to evaluate for any sort of neurological injury. It should be known that children with a developmental delay or autism may be more difficult to assess. Once we performed our primary survey and we obtained the initial imaging that we need, primarily the EFAST exam in most cases, we can start in on the secondary survey. The secondary survey, as a reminder for those who are not used to trauma, is a head-to-toe assessment where we're looking for injuries that are not an immediate threat to life, limb, or neurological. Rectal exams are no longer recommended to be performed routinely given its poor sensitivity. However, there may be times when it is still potentially beneficial. However, the genitals and perineum should still be evaluated, especially before placing a catheter. A negative exam and the absence of comorbid injuries does not necessarily rule out intra-abdominal injury. Abdominal tenderness, ecchymosis, and abrasions are concerning for intra-abdominal injury. A low systolic pressure, decreased level of consciousness, and signs of peritoneal injury are all very concerning and carry a higher risk of intra-abdominal injury. After you perform your assessment, you want to start considering diagnostic studies. And while the routine use of trauma panels is no longer recommended, there are two reasons to perform laboratory testing. And that's for the potentially unstable patient, as well as to screen a stable child for a possible intra-abdominal injury. The most useful tests are a CBC, liver function test, and urinalysis. An elevation of the AST, ALT, or hematuria in the presence of abdominal tenderness should be taken very seriously, as these patients have a higher risk of clinically important abdominal injury. Amylase and lipase, however, have not been proven to be useful. given the lifetime risk of malignancy and the potential exposure with intravenous contrast, computed tomography or CT should be avoided whenever possible, and this requires a more thoughtful approach of how to image these patients. And with our adult patients, we care about this, but not to the same extreme. But the younger we are, the higher the lifetime risk of fatal malignancy based on radiation exposure. The EFAS exam is widely used in adult patients, but the pediatric population is a little more controversial. However, it is very beneficial in that it is non-invasive and repeatable. While a negative exam may not necessarily be helpful, a positive EFAS exam can significantly impact patient management. However, CT with IV contrast has been the gold standard for abdominal imaging in trauma. Oral contrast may still be indicated in specific situations, such as if we suspect a pancreatic or hollow viscous injury. However, it is overall less widely used. Even a repeat CT exam is unlikely to confidently exclude a bowel injury, including when symptoms have been worsening since the previous exam. Children seen at community hospitals should avoid CT whenever possible, as these scans are often repeated in trauma centers and can further delay care in an appropriate setting. EB Medicine provided an excellent review on how to manage these patients, and I don't want to dive too much into how to manage these patients, but to focus on some of the key concepts, because each organ injury is managed a little bit differently. So we're going to take that complex topic and leave it alone, because oftentimes when you do identify a specific injury, your trauma centers are going to have specific recommendations as far as how to manage them. And so just keep in mind that it would be good to review when you read the EB Medicine article, but we're going to focus again on the highlights of management. Initial stabilization and providing hemodynamic stability is key in trauma. Generally, we want to avoid crystalloid fluids and go straight to blood products whenever possible because of the potential complications that occur with crystalloid fluids. However, crystalloid fluids may not always be possible, and based on some limited evidence, there may not be a huge difference in outcomes given the difference of blood products and crystalloid fluids. However, personally, I am a fan of giving blood products and avoiding crystalloid fluids whenever possible. If you were to give blood products, keep in mind that it's similar to crystalloid fluids in that you're giving 10 to 20 cc's per kg of packed red blood cells and fresh frozen plasma. If you were to give crystalloids, it's going to be that same sort of bolus. Again, the ultimate goal there is to achieve hemodynamic stability to provide for a safe transfer. One more thing I will bring up with the management that is very important, something I do not want you to forget in the mix of all this, and this should be true for any critical patient, but it annoys me most when I see it with children because for some reason we ignore it more in children, and that is to treat pain. There are tons of options to treat pain. Don't use hemodynamic stability as the only reason to not give pain medicine. The catecholamine surge that's there will not necessarily go away, and if you are truly worried in your ill or injured patient that they may get worse with it, then treat them. Treat them for getting their blood pressure and the other hemodynamics improved versus just saying, no, we can't treat it right now because their catecholamines are supporting it. And I'm worried about if I treat their pain, their catecholamines will decrease and that they'll get worse. If you know that's a problem, treat the symptoms, treat the issue at hand. If that means that you need to have some additional pressure support, or if that means you need to give boluses to help keep them stable, then do that. But don't ignore pain management and pick agents that are able to provide a more hemodynamic stable pain control. Now that I'm off my soapbox, let's talk about the clinical pathway for management of the pediatric patient with blunt abdominal trauma. I do have the graphic in the show notes and highly suggest that you look at it because it provides a very nice breakdown of what to do. The key part is that any patient who sustains blunt abdominal trauma, you need to perform that primary survey, get a good history, get a good physical exam, including that secondary exam like we were talking about, where you're going to do a head-to-toe assessment looking for DCAP BTLS or deformities, contusions, abrasions, punctures, penetrations, burns, tenderness, laceration, and swelling. Labs that are most helpful are CBC, LFTs, and urinalysis. If you begin fluid resuscitation, keep in mind that a 20 cc per kg bolus is often recommended for crystalloids first and then follow it up by blood products. However, in some cases, you may be better off just going straight to blood products. And then you should consider performing an EFAS exam whenever possible to further evaluate for any positive findings. Let's say you have a negative EFAS exam and the patient is stable. Well, you perform a secondary survey and there's no abdominal wall trauma, pain, tenderness, or vomiting. You then perform labs and there's no significant elevation of the AST, ALT, or a drop in the hemoglobin or hematocrit. If they are neurologically intact, there's no femur fracture, and their urinalysis does not demonstrate hematuria, then they probably have a low likelihood for intra-abdominal injury and could probably be discharged home, but if there is concern, you could observe them. Now, if any of those were positive during the assessment, then you would move over to potentially considering an abdominal CT. And if that was to be negative, you'd then do repeat physical exams and then possibly consider observation versus discharge. The patient with a positive EFAS exam but is stable, consider going to CT, but you could directly consult surgery given the significance of the findings. In the unstable patient, you should be calling surgery and starting transfusions. If there is any concern for an intestinal or a missed injury, again, consult surgery. So overall, we've talked about blunt abdominal trauma as far as the key highlights, why we had to be more concerned in pediatric patients, the key mechanisms, the main components of the assessment, as well as the highlights for management. This is meant to be a brief overview. The actual article from EB Medicine is very extensive and very thoughtful. I would highly recommend that you check out EB Medicine to get more information on this. If you don't have EB Medicine and you want to learn more, if you want to subscribe, which I'd highly recommend, then go to our website, podcast 188, or any other EB Medicine article. Go to the bottom of the page and it will say, if you want to find out more, you can get a subscription and save $50 or more off of the said subscription when you go through EB Medicine. Just click on our links at that bottom second paragraph to get the discounts. I hope you enjoy that. I enjoy doing EB Medicine articles because I learn a lot with these articles as well. I hope you do too. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.